Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. This is Frank McKay, and my very special guest today is one of the great producers of our time, or any time for that matter, Mark Berry. Mark, how are you?
Hey, Frank. Great to be with you, buddy.
Yeah, I just was talking to you off mic, and that's got to be ancient history. That's over 30 years ago. But I had told you that we had met in Brooklyn, which I think is your home.
Right.
Is that your hometown, Brooklyn?
Well, I was born in Massachusetts and then raised in New York and then moved to Brooklyn. And I lived, basically grew up in Sheepshead Bay. I got married in Sheepshead Bay. Had two beautiful daughters still in Brooklyn. So and Frankie's studio network is just around the corner on Alpha Avenue U. And I grew up on 12th between X and Y.
Wow. So that was early on in your career. That was Alicia, right? You had Alicia?
That was Alicia. That was the first record that that Maynard Solomon allowed me to produce for the label. I was basically an engineer working for the label since 78. Did all the dance disco records, the Pouzé, and just tons of cool records for the label, and also for outside companies as well.
Now, just a reminder, what's the label? What was the label's name?
Vanguard. Vanguard Records.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I did everything at Vanguard Studios. They had the studio down on 23rd Street across from, right next to the Chelsea Hotel.
Ah, yes, right.
Right across from the YMCA.
But Alicia, right, was one of the acts on there. It was a brand new act, and All My
right.
Passion was the song, and it might have went to number one. You refresh my memory.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did go to number one, and it went to number one dance, and then it crossed over onto the pop charts, and then Baby Talk actually went top 20 on the pop charts in America, which was her third single after Two Turned On.
Yeah, I mean, great, just a great record, but your track record over the years is just unbelievable, and a lot of different styles. I was just counting up and with a friend, and when we were talking about you, you've got to be over 30 gold or platinum records. I mean,
36.
I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, looking back.
Just to clarify.
Yeah. let's do a little bit of your history. You're sort of giving us a little bit of your history there. You were born in Massachusetts. You were raised where?
I was raised in New York, and then moved to Brooklyn, and then my parents moved to Westchester County in Bedford. So I went to Fox Lane High School. They figured getting the kids out of the city would keep us out of trouble. But little did they know, I got into more trouble in Bedford than I did in New York City. So, and then I moved back to Brooklyn.
How does a guy, not to cut you off, but how does a guy with that background somehow end up with the great Sir George Martin and working with him? That's all.
I'll tell you, it's an interesting story. I didn't want to go to Vietnam. So, as you know, when I was a teenager in high school, it was the height of the Vietnam War. So, so I just didn't want to go. I spoke to my parents. I registered at the Institute of Audio Research down in University Place by NYU, and I started going to engineering classes at night into Manhattan. So I did that for 2 years. I knew what I wanted to do, and then I turned 18 in high school, and they couldn't draft you if you were still in high school. So basically, the day after I graduated from high school, I got on a plane and went to London.
Well, it was a great move. It was a horrible war. I certainly respect all the people who went, but I certainly respect everybody who got out of that. I always say that, I have...
Well, I registered for the draft. I just wasn't around for them to find me for it. But, because, I mean, in my junior year, I was number 32 on the draft lottery. So had I been 18, I definitely would have gone. My birthday was picked, so it's like I definitely would have gone. And I turned... if I was out of high school and I was 18, I was gone. So, and as kids, you'd watch Walter Cronkite every night and you'd see body bags come off the plane. That's all we saw every night,
Bad war. So, just a bad war.
Bad war. And very bad.
Respect the guys who went. They had no choice and whatever. But anybody who left that war, I have four kids and I always said if there was a draft and there was another Vietnam, I'd drive them to Canada myself. They wouldn't even, I'd kidnap them.
Absolutely.
No doubt about
it. Absolutely.
And let me remind people that are just tuning in now or just turning on their radio that this is Frank McKay, but I'm speaking to really one of the great producers of our time or any time, Mark Berry. 36 gold and platinum records. Just an amazing, unbelievable career in a very difficult, very difficult field. So you end up going to Europe, going to England.
And yeah, I went to England. I pounded on doors for a couple of weeks, and I became friends with a kid named Nigel Walker, who was an assistant engineer at Air Studios, which was owned by four producers, one of them being George Martin. And I got invited into a session with an engineer named John Punter, and it was an Alan Clark session. Alan Clark was the lead singer of the Hollies. So they had just come off that big hit, Long Cool Woman, and I literally just sat in the corner. And if somebody needed cigarettes, I ran downstairs. If somebody needed a coffee, I ran upstairs. And that's really what I did. And then I asked if I could come back the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And then they stuck me with... I became a regular at the studio, just kind of hanging out, running errands for people, kind of like, you know, just a gopher, you know?
Were you getting paid in the beginning? Were you?
No, I wasn't getting paid, no pay. And then they approached me when they stuck me with an American client. And they said, do you want to, you know, work with Carly Simon? And I said, sure, yeah, she's from New York. And I said, great. So that was the beginning of my pay scenario. And just as an assistant engineer, I think I was making £50 a week. You know, it was like $100 a week back then. And I
that's not that bad, right? That's pretty decent.
No, I wasn't complaining at all. Not at all. And then I worked with Carly Simon, and that was my first credited record, the Your Sylvain album.
Wow. Nice first credited record to get. Let me jump around here a bit, and let's come back to this point. Remember that point where we stopped off, but let me let everyone know again. You have this background. You were born in Massachusetts. You end up in New York. When do you first get interested in music, and what was it that got you interested in music?
First interested when I was a kid, probably around 10, 11, 12 years old. Basically just listening to stereos and wondering why the music was on the left side and the drums were on the right side, and why Aretha Franklin's voice was so huge and on top of the mix. And so I just, that's how I got very interested in sound. And then I knew that I wanted to record, some sort of an engineer in the music field. So that's kind of how it evolved into what it was, you know. And then my dad had old, Louis Armstrong records and jazz records, Buddy Rich records. So I would always listen to those records as well.
So when you started listening and you started thinking about sound, does Phil Spector enter your life anywhere, at least?
Absolutely. No, he was very instrumental. All the the early Righteous Brother records and the Darlene Love records, and yeah, absolutely, it was very influential. Because that was the beginning of stereo, right? I mean, it was like, the drums are on the right, and the you know, the vocals are on the left, and I said, "Wow, that's a great sound." You know, you can separate them. You know,
how old were you before you realized that, hey, these bands aren't doing this alone? There's a guy like a director in a film, so to speak, a guy, a producer, walking in there, helping them get this sound, and there's an engineer. How soon before you started figuring that out?
I didn't know that there were two different people until later on. I thought the engineer was the producer and the producer was the engineer. And then I realized that they worked with different people. Somebody was a techie, basically, and someone was a muso, and that was the producer. The techie guy was obviously the engineer. So that's kind of how I got involved. I was more technically oriented. Than, like, my background's not in music. It's in the technical side of music. So, you know, now, you know, 40 years later, I know music. I can sit down and play the piano. No one taught me. I just kind of picked it up in studios watching Paul McCartney play, you know, piano during the outtakes of Live and Let Die. So, you know, you just kind of pick stuff up as you go along throughout the years. So, you know, play a little guitar, play a little piano, you know, enough to do a part in a song, if you hear something in your head. That's how much I know.
If you think about it, that's how the Beatles learned too. I mean, obviously they played their instruments, but I mean they learned how to play piano probably that same way as necessity for a song or to add to a song. Let me remind folks that Jay just may be tuning in or just turning on their radio that this is Frank McKay and Mark Berry, just an award-winning 36 Golden Platinum Records. I don't know if you call them Golden Platinum Records anymore. The old ones you do, but what do you...
I don't even know what qualifies for them anymore. You know, it used to be hard sales, but now they put a little bit of streaming in, they put a little downloads in, they put a little hard sales in, and I guess that's what the award is now.
It's changed so much, and you've seen...
You've
seen all of it, actually.
Right.
You've seen the change from analog to digital. You've seen pre-Napster, where,
right.
You know, after Napster, piracy just became ridiculous. Before that, you saw the MTV generation, and you saw what happened there. But you've been working in a very interesting time in the music business, and... You know, in some ways, you're blessed by timing. And I say this to a lot of folks. You were blessed by timing because you had a lot of hits prior to Napster. And right around the time when MTV was taking off, you were taking off. And so, I mean, you were blessed by timing in a sense. And you didn't, I'm sure you lost a lot of royalties post-Napster or whatever. But prior to that... is when you probably really did well. And on top of that, you got into it after the, you know, and I'm not saying there weren't thieving record labels after that, but really in the 60s, there were bands like, you know, Tommy James, and you hear the horror stories with Tommy James and Roulette Records and the 50s and 60s. If you were around during that time, you would have gotten beaten by labels or whatever.
Right,
so
right.
You really came in at a nice time. Have you ever looked at it like that?
The Vanguard days were, you know, when I came back from London, I mean, that was an experience unto itself. So I spent a couple of years hanging out at Air Studios with George Martin and, you know, worked with some great, great artists. And then I came back to New York, and I walked around the streets of New York for a couple of years and then started doing some, you know, freelance apprentice work in New York City. And then the best thing that ever happened to me was meeting Maynard and Seymour Solomon at Vanguard Records, because that was a record label that had their own studio, own in-house production, you know. So I was working in the engineering department, and, you know, I was, you know, remastering old Joan Baez records, old Pete Seeger records, but I was also recording James Moody and Bunky Green and doing classical sessions with Seymour, and also going upstairs and seeing what the distribution looks like, what the promotion is, the marketing, the sales, the art department. I mean, I literally saw it all by working at there, and I worked there almost 12 years. So it was a great deal of experience there.
Let's jump back to Carly Simon. That's where we jumped off.
Sure.
When you're over in England and you get an opportunity to do Carly Simon. Do you know who she is, other than the fact that she's from New York? And she's, did she have any kind of name prior to that?
Yeah, she did. She had that one hit. Which was on her first album. This, I believe, was her second album, the No Secrets album. And it was a record that had some great musicians on it. Outstanding musicians, and they came to England to get away from the Los Angeles scene. So they recorded the bulk of it at Trident, and then they did all the vocals, and a lot of the overdubs were done over at Air Studios. I remember, you know, Paul and Linda McCartney coming over to Studio B to sing some background vocals, and Carly walking over and singing some background vocals with Paul and Linda on the Live and Let Die soundtrack, the James Bond soundtrack. And then, you know, of course, Mick Jagger, you know, he sang background vocals on You're So Vain. He actually wasn't even supposed to sing background vocals on it. It was supposed to be Harry Nilsson, because Harry Nilsson's producer was Richard Perry, and Richard was producing the No Secrets albums, and Richard produced the Nilsson Schmilsson album, which is a brilliant pop record. I Can't Live Living This Without You. And
Great album. Just a great album.
Great pop record. So, anyway... Harry was a notorious alcoholic, and he came to the studio that night, just happened to be hanging out and getting drunk with Mick, right? So Harry actually passed out in the lobby, and they just said, "Hey, Mick, you want to sing the background parts, you know?"
That's funny. Wow.
And that's really how that's really how Mick came to sing the background parts of Yusuf. He sings the chorus sections on Yusuf Sylvain. Which led to the speculation that everyone thought it was about Mick Jagger, but in actuality it wasn't.
Wow, that's funny. Yeah, actually, that debate goes on still about that. Yeah, that's amazing. But you mentioned Harry Nilsson. He was part of that famous Lost Weekend with John Lennon, and you know, talk about a guy being a bad influence. I mean, a great artist, but man, he was you're right. He had his demons. You know, certainly.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, he was a brilliant musician. Unfortunately, his demon was alcohol, and eventually killed him. He died from alcoholism.
When Harry Nilsson, a guy like Harry Nilsson, comes into the studio, and I don't know, George Martin wasn't involved in that session, right? Was he?
No, it was Richard Perry was
Richard
producing.
Richard Perry, okay. Does a guy?
Robin Cable was engineering. I was assistant, and then I would get behind the board and do some engineering as well.
You know, Richard Perry, who worked with Barbara Streisand and all types of people.
Yeah, absolutely.
When Harry Nilsson comes in, is Richard Perry like, you got to be kidding. The guy's drunk. He's coming into a session. This is ridiculous.
No, you know, I think Harry, Richard knew the game with Harry for sure. And basically, just Harry went out to the lobby of the studio and just kind of passed out on the studio couch, you know, and nobody could wake him up. So it's like, hey, Mick, you're up, you know.
Well, not a bad replacement to have. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to really just an unbelievable talent, production talent, and that's Mark Berry. And like we said, we keep saying 36 gold and platinum records. That's just like a ridiculous number. And there's only a handful of you guys that are out there that could even talk like this. And just, you know, to the people, if you did the 6 degrees of separation of Mark Berry, I don't think it would make, certainly in the music business, it would make Kevin Bacon blush. You know, it's unbelievable. And what a career. And it's still going strong. How did you end up in Canada now?
Okay. So, my attorney in Paul Schindler from the very early Alicia days, there's a guy named Paul Schindler in New York, and Paul's been like...
That was Grubman, Grubman Schindler, and Dursky.
Grubman and Dursky and Schindler, correct, at the time. And Paul was my very first attorney in the music business, and he set me up, and we've been good friends to this day. He's still my attorney, and I've known him 30-plus years. We just did the Drake movie together. We're still...
You did the music for that? You did the music for the Drake movie?
AMG is an executive producer of the new Drake film, Homecoming.
No kidding. Oh, good for you. Wow.
Yeah, so we're in the feature-length film business now. Getting to Canada, Paul represented, or Artie Indersky, Paul's partner, represented a Canadian management company that had a big band up here called Platinum Blonde. They're kind of like the Bon Jovi of Canada. And,
sure, big band.
Yeah, big band up here. And he put me together with the band's management company. And then I did a record with Kenny McLean, who was the bass player for that. And Kenny since passed away, but we did a great record and won a Juno, which is the Canadian Grammy version. And I became in demand as a producer and engineer. And it was only an hour and a half away by plane. To come up here and work, and I just came up and started working and doing a lot of recording, a lot of mixing, a lot of producing, and then I discovered a band up here called I Mother Earth, and we put a deal together for them, and that was a very popular deal, and I did 2 platinum albums with the Headstones, which are a large Canadian rock band. I did the live Burton Cummings Unplugged, MTV Unplugged album I produced. You know, it's been good. It's been really good to me up here, absolutely.
All right. Again, this is Frank McKay, and I have the pleasure of speaking to really one of the great producers out there, and that's Mr. Mark Berry. He's got every award and everything you could imagine doing. Mark, let me tell you my Paul Schindler story. I've never met Paul,
okay.
But I remember some people at a record label, you know, Mercury, and at the time, Alan Grubman was his partner, and he got most of the, in my mind, he got most of the press. He always heard Grubman. But somebody told me about Paul Schindler. They said, you know, like when they sat around for an A&R meeting, they said, well, who's negotiating the deal, you know, for the artist? And they said, Paul Schindler. And he said, the whole place just went silent. And then everyone went, ooh, Paul Schindler.
Yeah. He's a great guy. He's a dear friend.
But he's a killer. He's a killer negotiator.
Yeah, well, he's got your back. As an attorney, he's got your back. He's not going to let anyone screw around with you.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah, just what a reputation to have when a whole label says just go silent when he comes up in the A&R meeting and everyone goes, ooh.
Absolutely. I remember him on the phone with Seymour Stein one time. They were renegotiating a Madonna contract. And he had Madonna for many, many, many years, from day one, actually, because he had Jelly Bean. And Jelly Bean and Madonna were dating, so Jelly Bean brought Madonna to Paul. And I remember him just screaming in the phone one day at Seymour Stein saying, if you don't do this deal, I'm going to screw you so hard on the next Madonna negotiation. It's like, you're going to regret you ever met me. And I was like, all right, I want that lawyer as my lawyer.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. Listen, we're coming up on a break. Mark Berry is my special guest. This is Frank McKay. Thrilled to have a great producer like Mark Berry. And all of his stories are amazing. All of his work is amazing. Mark Berry, we'll be back right after this quick break. This is Frank McKay. We'll be back. I'd like to welcome everyone back to Breaking It Down. This is Frank McKay, and my very special guest is just a great producer. He's seen everything. Mr. Mark Berry, 36 gold and platinum records to his credit. He has worked with everyone that you can imagine. Hey, Mark, for people that are interested in following what you're doing, do you have a site to point to? I know a lot of confusion
right.
out there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Absolutely, yeah. We have several sites, and we're right now going through this strategic rebranding of the company because it's been Attack Media Group is now AMG. And under AMG is Mark Berry, the producer. We've got Devel Promotion and Marketing. MarkBerry.com was my site. Devel.com was the promotion and marketing site. We have Attack Tracks, TRAX.com. That's our online music supervision division. And we're going to incorporate all of this, with the exception of Attack Tracks, into a corporate site called the AMGCorp.com. So that's going to be our brand new site. Probably should be up in about 30, 60 days.
Let me jump back to London and the first impression that you had of George Martin. Was he an intimidating type figure? Was he a... obviously, everyone in the room has to have a ton of respect for him at that point.
Absolutely. You know, he was a gentle guy, thoughtful, patient, always knew what he wanted to hear, And that stuck with me, that he never settled on any performance unless it was in his head, and that's exactly what he heard on tape, on playback.
Now,
so that's really what I learned from Sir George Martin.
Now, was he a delegator, or was he more of a controlling type personality, or is
no,
he the type
he let it,
just got it
yeah,
done?
He let everyone do their thing. Everyone did their thing, and you know he was the guy at the end of the assembly and put the car together. You know, he just kind of collated all these ideas on like an assembly line and then blah, 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 put all the pieces together and bang, there was your record. You go, wow, that sounds great.
Now, how about you? Do you have a similar style or a methodology?
Yeah, I'm of the same ilk. I always know what I want to hear. I always am of the belief that if you don't know what you want to hear and you go into the studio, that's when your problems begin. But if you have a very clear vision about what something is supposed to sound like and what the performance is supposed to be like, then it's smooth sailing.
Is there anyone who stands out to you as someone that you've worked with and you were given the impression prior to working with them that they were difficult and that they had a difficult personality to produce or to handle, and it turned out to be just the opposite. They turned out to be...
Jeff Lynne from Electric Light Orchestra. I did the Rollover Beethoven record. He was like a notorious perfectionist, but I never found his perfectionism to be a problem in the studio. Again, it comes back to that he always knew what he wanted to hear, you know? And he always had great ideas, like all those ELO drums, they're all drums that are recorded twice by the same drummer. So they record one drum track, and then they record the exact same thing again. And that's that ELO drum sound. It's you know, it's kind of like a little phasey, you know, the cymbals are swishy, but it's huge. It's a massive drum sound.
Yeah, that's Spectre-ish in a sense, too. You know, it's kind of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, let me let me ask you this. I heard, you know, the great, late great Phil Ramone once say that when he first, or when he started working with Billy Joel, they had a great take, a really great take, but it came at the very first take that they took. And Billy Joel had the type of personality that if it came too easy, it mustn't be good, right? So he erased it. He said, no, we got to get it. We got to do it again. And Phil Ramone was saying, I think it was really good. I think you should really keep it. And he talked him out of it. And Billy Joel said, no, come on, we can get it better. And they erased it. And, you know, Ramone went along with him. And they went on, and he never quite got to where that first take was. And he learned the lesson. And he said that once that happened again, what he would do is he would just lie and say, okay, we're erasing,
right,
keep the take,
yeah,
and kind of go on.
That's right.
That's how they would get it.
I always lied.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you're always right. So you come across that quite a bit. That's not a unique situation.
No. That's the insecurity of the artist, right? That's the ingrained insecurity of the creative artist, right? They always think there's another performance that's better, when in actuality, the first second they opened their mouth was the keeper.
Let me remind everyone once again, Mark Berry, great producer, music producer, record producer, whatever you want to call him nowadays. There's no such thing as records, I guess. Well, there are, but
yeah,
a little more vague at this point. Mark Berry, just a wonderful talent as a producer, is our special guest. This is Frank McKay. Mark, when you look at all the different artists that you've worked with over the years and the different personalities, is there a type of personality that, I mean, obviously you can kind of pick and choose who you want to work with nowadays. Is there a type of personality, and I'm not asking you for a specific person, but is there a type of personality that you just refuse to work with?
No. I mean, basically there's so many different personalities in the music business. When you get someone in the studio and there's pressure to deliver additional recordings that sound as great as the previous recordings, no, there's all types of different personalities. You know, I always say being a record producer is kind of like being a psychiatrist as well. You really have to learn how to deal with personalities, how to get around them. You know, you're not dealing with one guy, you're dealing with four guys, you know. One guy may be the stronger personality of those four guys, but those other three guys still got opinions about what's going on.
Let me ask you the reverse. Is there a personality that, and it might sound obvious, you know, that somebody would want just an easy personality, but I don't think it's that easy. Is there a type of personality that you can't get enough of in the studio?
Yeah, the type of personality that I like is the type of guy that knows every instrument, that can come in and play a piano, guitar, bass, drums, you know, a Stevie Wonder, a Paul McCartney, you know, like it just, because they hear all the parts in their head, right? So the music is already pre-written, right?
Yeah. Well, let's jump back to London. I mean, it's such an interesting moment in time, you know, for everybody in history, never mind just you being part of it and being involved in it. But Carly Simon walks in, she does You're So Vain, and somewhere around that time period, Paul and Linda are working, right? And they're doing there. Now, Carly Simon, you got to view Carly Simon working with Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney?
Yeah, well, we were in Studio B doing the No Secrets album, and we were also in Studio C doing No Secrets. And George and Wings were in Studio A, because that was the big orchestral room, and they were doing the soundtrack to Live and Let Die.
Now, was Carly Simon to you, was she starstruck by them, or was she just...
No. It wasn't that kind of vibe at all. It was like friends and buddies. It was like, you know, Paul and Linda would just, you know, they'd wander down the hallway in their bare feet, walk in, hey, what's going on over here, you know? And then, hey, you want to sing some background vocals? And, you know, and that's, you know, they're singing background parts with Carly Simon, you know?
That's an amazing situation to have people of that stature just to be, you know, that relaxed about something like
that.
It was a
really cool vibe. And I think from the Live and the Die soundtrack and the No Secrets album, you can tell, I mean, those records are great recordings, you know, great performances, you know?
Well, let me ask you the same thing about Mick Jagger. What was he like? coming in there. He substituted for a drunken Harry Nilsson.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was a drunken Mick Jagger, but he knew how to perform under the alcohol. You know, Harry did. Harry knew how to sleep.
Yeah. So he was drunk when he sang "You're So Vain."
Yeah. He was hammered. But you know, he came in. He sang it. You know, without a hitch, without a problem, and it was done in an hour. You know, all those parts were done. And then I remember Carly and Mick just sitting down at the piano singing old blues songs, both sitting on the bench, you know. And then that evening, we went over to Olympic Studios where Andy Johns was mixing the live 72 tour tapes. We were doing overdubs with Bobby Keys and Jim Price, who actually did horns on the No Secret album as well for Carly Simon. So it's kind of like everybody was in London together, right?
If God forbid the Germans would have picked that point to come together and bomb, they would have destroyed a lot of talent. Andy
Johns,
just in that way. I mean, what a magical period in time just to witness that.
I'm 18 years old. Can you imagine me? I'm in a taxi cab with Mick Jagger going to Olympic Studios from Air Studios, hanging out with Mick Jagger and Carly Simon and Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney. And then we're hanging out with Andy Johns, who, for me, being an engineer, I'm going, holy, Andy Johns, who's Glyn Johns' brother, right? That says it all.
Yeah.
Right? And then I'm going out to the studio, and I'm walking around, and we're doing horn overdubs with Bobby Keys and Jim Price. They're redoing some of the horn parts that are on the 72 tour tapes. And then I see these drum risers with mics underneath the drum risers, and I go to Andy, what's that all about? And he goes, oh, that's John Bonham's drum setup. And I'm going, oh my God, this is like overkill here.
Yeah, that's just unbelievable. And now, when do you decide to leave Europe, and why do you decide to leave England?
Well, I had immigration problems. I was obviously just being an assistant. I had an immigration issue, so I was only there for 2 years. And then I came back to New York, walked around the streets of New York for a while, and then I got a job with a guy named Ed Chalpin at TTX Enterprises. And it was just like a jingle studio and stuff, and they were up on 54th Street and 8th Avenue. And then I got the call from Vanguard, and I met with Maynard Solomon, and I was just basically an assistant engineer at the studio doing tape copies. And then it just kind of morphed into an engineer situation, and then I was bringing in clients. I was instrumental in as an engineer with all the early Afrika Bambaataa records with Arthur Baker and John Rovey. Records were done at Vanguard, and between Vanguard and Unique Studios.
Now you're walking around here, right? You have the immigration issues. You got to come back here, and you're still young. You're still 18 or you're 19? How old?
No, like 20. I'm going on 21.
You're going on 21. Do you have a physical resume in your hand? Are you even thinking like that, or is it just a verbal resume?
No, I had a physical resume of what I was doing at Air Studios, and I had a letter of recommendation from George Martin, and I just sent those out, and I got a job rather quickly.
Again, Mark Berry is my very special guest. This is Frank McKay, but more importantly, Mark Berry has seen it all, just a legendary producer, 36 gold and platinum records, Juno Awards, just everything you could imagine. He has the Midas touch, and he's one of that handful of people. You know, you could take guys like you and, throw Jack Douglas, Eddie Kramer, and that. You could take all of you and you can put them in a small restaurant, and it's just... And that's it. It's a small club of you guys.
The stories we'd come up with would be incredible. Yeah,
but I mean, they're not making any more of you either, and especially with the music business, the way it's gone.
No, not at all. In fact, even as an engineer, I never rode the digital curve because I felt that there were people out there that did it better than I did, and quite frankly, I just didn't like the sound.
Well, you're using Pro Tools or something now, right? Logic.
Yeah, of course. Nobody makes tape anymore. I can't use tape anymore.
Right. Now, did you have a hard time getting to that point? Were you stubborn? Were you one of those stubborn guys?
No. I kind of embraced it, but what did bother me about it was the inability to... I never liked making this record in a little box. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I wanted to make a record in a big, you know, 8 foot long SSL console where I grab one side of my sliding chair and slide all the way down to the other, and big monitors and big speakers and parametric EQ, and you only had that 1176 and you used it on the bass drum or the vocal, or, you know, now in a Pro Tools, you got 128 1176. So it's like, you know, I sit in my office all the time now. I just say to my staff, who's this? Because it all sounds the same to me. Sonically, it's just all the same.
Yeah.
There's no separation from the boards, the SSL, the Trident, the API, the Neve, right? The MCI. These were all boards that had very distinct sounds to them.
Yeah, you know, like the 8068, right? The Neve 8068.
Yeah,
everyone was always looking for that board, and it was like two in all of New York, and just a crazy time. Actually, there were two on Long Island at one time.
Yeah, and that's what I trained at Vanger at Air Studios. I mean, they had three Neves. Right, so I knew that sound inside, and then I come to Vanguard, and they got a need. I'm like, oh God, I'm at home right now, man. This is great.
You know, and again, it's a small community. I remember an engineer almost knocked me over. I think I was at Unique, and we were doing some demo, and Rupert Neve had walked into
System,
and this guy ran down there with a module. He had like one of the, you know, just one module of a Neve, and he ran down. Yeah, you would think Mickey Mantle had just come in, a kid, and he ran down, and he had Rupert Neve sign his thing. It's, but these are no longer situations. It's, I mean, can you get, and I don't know Pro, you know, you, I'm sure you know Pro Tools inside and out, or Logic or whatever, Cubase. Can you get a Neve 8068 sound out of the digital?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Just doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. These are things of the past, and I don't know that anybody's going to care, because it's going to...
Nobody does care. You know, I got a 19-year-old daughter. She doesn't care. She doesn't know an MP3 from a wave. You know, it's no longer about the Sonics. You know, kids that are listening in their headphones and their earphones on iPhones, they don't care what it sounds like. They just have it down. They have the song. That's all they care about.
Are your daughters doing music?
No, I got two daughters in Brooklyn. One's a principal, and Bianca is a teacher for special needs. And my daughter Sabrina in Canada is in school in Ottawa for international law.
Oh, terrific. Yeah. I mean, I meet more musicians and more music people nowadays, and it's becoming a trend, and less and less of their kids are going into their parents' business.
Right.
And I think it's because of the piracy. It's a very difficult deal now.
No, it's very hard. It's very hard to make money on that, and from that, you know, from that end of the business. But it's certainly easier to, you know, you can put something in a movie or TV show and make more on the insertion, the master and sync fee, than you can on the actual sale of the CD.
See, that's an interesting point. A lot of these guys, their kids, and I don't have time to sit here and name all the people I've interviewed, that kids are now going into visual mediums.
Right.
And it sounds like the parents are kind of urging them to do it. I mean, without them saying that, obviously the line is, we want to do whatever they love to do, and we all agree as parents, we all get that. But musicians and producers and executives, I realize how difficult it was back then. I mean, you succeeded at a time. Let's not make it sound like it was easy to succeed. You're in a handful of people. You're in the elite, and it was tough to make it back then. Nowadays, it's just you know, what a deal. Now, what about the visual mediums? I mean, you're getting into that yourself, your company, and let's talk about that. We got a few minutes left with Mark Berry. Let's talk about what you're doing now.
Okay, well, we have the AMG Visuals, which is a music, film, and television company. And what we do is we put music into feature-length films and television programs. But I've also gotten into the production of films. We're executive producers of the new Drake film called Homecoming, which just came out last week in Canada and internationally. And we're doing broadcast deals right now for it, and DVD deals. We just signed Sony Red. And then I'm involved with a new James Brown film as well, which is his last live concert.
Let me ask you this: what percentage of your new entity is doing film compared to music?
I'm pushing more into the film area. I think there's more avenues of revenue there than there is.
Is it 50-50? Is it more film than music? What is it? What's the...
Yeah, it's 50-50 here now, but I see it going, you know, upwards of 70-30, absolutely.
So many more avenues to go. I mean, that's no longer three major networks. There's hundreds of networks, and it's out there. We got about 2 minutes left. Mark Berry, where can people follow you? Where can people go? Let's give the website again, and let's give any social media that you have. That
sure, yeah, Berry Marquez for Twitter, Marquez Berry for Facebook. The AMG Corp will be our brand new website, and that should be up and running in about 30 to 60 days. MarkBerry.com is my producer site. And Devel.com is our promotion and marketing site. And AttackTrax is our online music supervision, film and television, music supervision division.
Now, any advice for people out there that are looking to reach out to you? Do you guys take unsolicited material? Do you get requests? And honestly, I mean, are people wasting their time if they reach out to you and say, hey, I got this great idea? What's the process?
No, not at all. I mean, if you want to send me some music, absolutely, mark@attackmediagroup.com. All the time, getting, you know, nobody sends me CDs anymore. They just shoot me an email with two or three songs on. And then some people are just looking for promotion and marketing services, which we do. We do license deals all over the world. We put songs in movies, TV shows, video games, ad agencies, movie trailers. You know, wherever you can seek a usage, that's going to pay you money back, because you're not going to make money selling content.
Well, let me just say, it's always special talking to someone who does something very, very, very well. And this individual that I've been speaking with for this last hour certainly falls in that category. His name is Mark Berry, producer extraordinaire, just an incredible career, and it's still going strong. 36 gold and platinum records, and, you know, now film, the new Drake film. Mark, thank you very much for being here.
Frank, my pleasure, man. Great to hear your voice again. Many, many moons we met, man. Many moons ago.
Sounds great. Congratulations on everything and everything in the future. Mark Berry, everyone, has been our very special guest. This is Frank McKay. We will see you next time on Breaking It Down.